Welcome to the Resilient Kids podcast. And today I have Karen talking with me about her amazing work, which is to support parents. Well, actually, you're an optometrist, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
And I've asked you to speak to me today to help parents know what they can do to support their children's good eye care. But I'd like you to introduce yourself and to tell the listeners about your role.
So as Madeline said, my name's Karen Drabitsky and I'm actually an optometrist in Wellington at one of the independent practices, Black Gates Optometrists. I've been there for over 25 years now and obviously seen quite a difference in optometry and the role we play in children's vision through that time. Being a community practice, quite a lot of families that come in, so we have a range from younger children right through the whole life spectrum of adults as well. So yeah, and I guess having children of my own, I'm pretty enthusiastic and excited to be able to see children and support them, yeah, through the needs that they need and their vision and their visual development.
And what are some of the concerns or issues that you're starting to see or that you have been seeing that have changed over those kind of 20 years?
So there's definitely been huge developments in myopia, which is the short-sightedness, and worldwide it's becoming more and more of an issue. And I would say the way that we treat a child who presents to us as being short-sighted or even comes from a family where short-sightedness is a risk, we do things quite differently to when we first started practicing. So, and particularly I'd say in the last decade or more, it's getting a lot more mainstream, and the treatment that people are being offered for that is radically different from before.
Okay. So before you get into the treatment options, can you tell us a little bit about why you think we're seeing more and more of this issue to do with children and what the restrictions are for them because of that development?
Yeah, so it's probably a little bit of environmental and genetics as well. So, you know, if you'd asked me sort of 20, 30 years ago, it was definitely much more common in East Asia. So, for example, I think when they looked at the Taiwanese military service, about 97% of them are short-sighted. So, you know, there's definitely high percentages, whether if you go to somewhere like Ethiopia, it's 4%, you know, quite difference in between different countries. And lifestyle has changed. Things that we do now are quite different to how we were in past generations. And there's, yeah, definitely a mix of environmental factors. They're still learning some of those, but definitely indoor activities or not being as outdoorsy as much as we used to is playing a factor. The use of devices or just near work in general, whether that is an iPad or your device, or whether it's just doing lots of closer up work and close up activities, and usually they're indoors, so in that dimmer light. So there's possibly quite a mix if you have the family genetics. One parent or two parents that are short-sighted or myopic, then there's a much higher risk that you'll have short-sighted children. So, yeah, probably a mix of all of those.
Mm. And so some of the things that maybe our parents could be thinking about in terms of prevention, what are you thinking about that?
One of the big things that they found, and they even did a study in Sydney, which is quite beneficial because it was quite a multicultural study. Some of the studies are very much in one ethnic group, depending on where their study is based. But they did one in Australia with a multicultural school and found that children that spent on average 2 hours outside each day had a lower incidence of becoming myopic compared to children who didn't. So that doesn't just mean you have to go outside for a 2 hour period. It just means that you could walk to school, you could go outside at lunch, you could, you know, intermittently do that through the day. But if you were averaging a decent amount of time outdoors, and it doesn't have to be even running outdoors or being active outdoors, just being outside can help to slow down the progression or the onset, the start of myopia.
So it might be also useful to talk about what is myopia and why does going outdoors make a difference?
So myopia or short-sightedness means where your distance vision is less clear than your close-up vision. So you have more trouble seeing further away. Most of the time comes because as the eye develops and grows, which it does slowly, but it does keep growing from when you're born. But in short-sighted children, their eye gets longer than it should do. And so the light just can't focus on the back of the eye anymore. So how do we stop the eye from growing longer is the question. How does that being outside help? They aren't even 100% sure. There's so much we know in the world, but we don't know everything. And it's possibly the amount of light. So when you're outside, the volume of light is so much brighter than being indoors, which we know about when you go outside and have to squint in the sun or, you know, try to turn lights on inside. It's much brighter outside. Also, you've got less things near you. So there's less objects in your closer range of focus and more objects further away. So it's probably, again, a combination between both of those.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. And what happens when a child actually does develop this myopia?
They will often get symptoms if it's a little bit higher, maybe not so much at the early stages, and their distance vision gets harder. So you tend to find that they squint more to see things further away or walk closer to be able to see it. Again, when you asked me when I first started practicing, we would give them glasses, possibly even a slightly lower prescription than what we measure to try and not go too strong in an attempt to slow down the rate of change, whether now that is radically different. And we have a whole mix of options for children that include glasses that are in a special design, or contact lenses, or a pharmaceutical like an eye drop that they can use.
Okay. And are there other kind of exercises and things that can help children to...
So lifestyle and things helps as well. So sometimes we do exercises if their focusing system isn't working correctly. So sometimes if the way the eyes align together, or the way they overfocus or underfocus, which is their sort of readapting focus from close to far or moving it around, if it's not very pliable, we can do activities either in office or with at home training to support that. But that's not every child. So that's very child dependent when we do our measurements. Other things that they can do is, and not more than a couple of hours of closer up work. So school time, you're outside of school time. So coming home from school and then spending the next 3 hours doing homework and on a device and things isn't beneficial. Having that outside time or time away from that to balance it. Another tip is not getting too close to something. So your focusing demand as you get closer exponentially gets more demanding. So taking something from 50 to 45 centimeters increases the demand of and the amount you have to focus. Going from 30 to 25 centimeters is drastically more, even though it's a 5 centimeter change as well. It's just more effort. So we use the elbow rule. And that can apply, even adults tend to do it. If you put your knuckle fist on your chin, how far away your elbow is where you should hold things. So in an adult, that's more like about 40 centimeters. In a child, it's going to be a bit closer. But if they are holding something within that range, much, much closer, they will feel more relaxed. And it's better for them if they can push it back a little bit.
Right. Okay. So helping our children to be able to extend that distance between their eyes and the actual device or the book or whatever it is that they're reading.
Yeah.
When you're thinking about the other concerns that you see that would help parents to understand what they can do to support their children's healthy eyesight, what are the things that you would like us to talk about?
So, if you've got any concerns at all, I think it's worth getting an assessment to make sure that things are okay. And I've had a few children lately who have been around the age of 3 and their parents have said, we got told by somebody not to worry about it until they were older. At 3, they're too young to do something with. But they had, quite significant visual errors in their focusing that needed to be dealt with while their brain was still growing. Like anything, when you learn new languages or you're learning to move your body, you're learning new skills. If you can start doing that when you're younger, your brain is more pliable, it's got more ability to adapt and learn. So definitely, there's no sort of age that's too young. And if you think that your child's not seeing correctly, shutting one eye, turning their head, is, you know, not performing at a level that you would have expected for their age, it's definitely worth getting their eyes assessed. And I guess a lot of it, even like we talked about the outside time with short-sightedness, a lot of the things that our parents kind of told us to do or our grandparents told us to do can be beneficial. So like getting outside, it's good for us both in our eye development as well as our physical and emotional development. So some of the games and the things that we do with kids, and you send them to, you know, to kindergarten, you're like, oh, are they actually, you know, is that relevant? Is my child learning because they're just playing with blowing bubbles? All of that is actually really important for visual development as well. So there's activities that I would, you know, strongly suggest that people do for visual development, and some of it's with how the eyes move, so getting them to track and to follow. So
can you tell us about what kind of age group you'd be working in here?
Yeah, so with these, I would be saying, like, even with your preschoolers, doing things like the blowing the bubbles, get them to follow them, catch them with their fingers. It's all to do with their eyes tracking, rolling balls towards them, getting them to push them away, balloons where you blow them up, hit them around in the air and stop them hitting the ground, all sort of tracking, getting the eyes to move, and then getting your body involved with it as well. Then as the child gets older and they're maybe more with pencils and pens and getting into the schooling things where they have to follow things around, whether it's like a maze or dot to dot and things where they're planning where they're going and tracking along or looking along an expected route, all of those things then will relate to reading and things when you really want your eyes to track in straight lines and to know where they're planning to go. So a lot of those games where you're looking at things that are moving and following them around in space, really good. The other thing with vision, with visual perception, so the way that you see things and then you integrate it into what you do is important as well. So it's, you might see the thing clearly, but what do you do with it once you've seen it? So when kids are really little, like the memory kind of games, we play Snap or something. Are these two things the same? I can step when I see it. Turning things over, the memory game, trying two pairs that match together, those sort of things. The Where's Wally or those Find It books where you have a whole complex picture and you're looking for bits of information within it and spot the difference where you have like two photos or two things that are similar and what's the same and what's different. All looking at it and then turning that information into something that's perceivable. So yeah, lots and lots of game type things. And we, you know, maybe sometimes as parents go, oh, that's just a waste of time building that tower. You know, is it teaching them anything? Well, yes, because they're tracking those things. They're working out what's bigger, what's smaller, what place it fits in. So a lot of those things you need before you start becoming more academic and doing your schoolwork and things when you kind of get older through primary school.
So those are all games that we can play at preschool that help to scaffold the learning for future ability to better cope with more complex ideas.
Yeah, and it's like a building where you've got a really good foundation. If you've got a broad, solid foundation, you can put a lot more on top of it. So instead of, yeah, racing into, oh, can they identify what's A, B, C, you know, do they know which way round things go, what's up, what's down, what's left, what's right, is something bigger, smaller, different. So all of those games are actually not just for the fun of having a game. They're actually really good for development and building that foundation so you've got other things to build on top of.
Right. Hey, I also heard an interview just yesterday actually about light and the impact of LED lighting on and artificial light on eyes, and people talk about blue screens and, you know, the impact of that on children and adults for that matter. But I'm wondering if you could share some information or ideas that you might have about that.
Yeah, so artificial lighting isn't as bright as being outside. So if you can have more natural lighting, you are much better off in general. Without circadian rhythm, it's like when we know it's daytime and nighttime, when are we going to be awake, alert, rearing to go? When are we winding down to go to sleep? That's all important too, which we sometimes can lose with that artificial lighting and the different spectrums of whether it's a cool or a warmer light. There's thought that blue light can damage the eye, and children's eyes do let more blue light come in than older lenses and adult eyes. It's a bit more limited, but as to how much damage that produces to our retina or our internal eyes, they can't definitely say yet. So I would say things like sun protection is going to be more important, and natural light. And then, yeah, dimming that light as we get towards the evening, so that by the time you get to the evening, everything's not lit up particularly with the cooler blue light spectrum, but sort of more with the warm light spectrum, and starting to get dimmer, getting our melatonin levels to kind of kickstart so that we can get ready for sleep rather than being all wound up and out of kilter with that. So yeah, it's I guess again, our lifestyles change. We're not just, you know, with lighting and all this internal thing, we're not relying on the daylight outside to regulate ourselves. And that can help with, yeah, learning we want to be active, ready to go through the day, and then winding down to sleep so that our body is ready, our brains are ready to charge up for the next day.
And what about eye strain and tiredness for people who are looking at screens or books or I don't know, sewing or, you know, anything that's close up? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Our bodies like to move. So if you were stacking books on a shelf, you'd be able to do it for a lot longer than holding out one book in front of you for a period of time, for example. So our eyes like to move. So if we're doing lots on computer work or reading or close up, we need to vary that distance back and forwards a little bit. We need to take regular breaks so that we're moving. They talk about the 20-20 rule, which is every 20 minutes to take a 20-second break by looking at something 20 feet away. It's obviously American. But it's just that variety. So having those breaks, having that time where we're just moving. We blink a lot less when we're concentrating and searching for information, which is computer reading, drawing, colouring, all those kind of times. So having those breaks gets our blink rate and stops our dry eyes, which can often lead to those kind of tired feelings as well. So it's probably like everything, a little bit in moderation and then lots of variety and still trying to keep things moving.
Okay, that's really interesting. I hadn't ever thought about the kind of the blinking.
Because it should be, you know, quite a lot higher. If you're just doing a conversation or looking around, you will, blink more often than your blinks are fast. You see through them, but they definitely do slow down quite a bit when you're reading or doing close up. On the computer, you're looking up a bit higher and having a slower blink rate. So your eyes can get drier again because they're more exposed. So computer users will have more dry eye issues than readers, because when you're looking down to read, half to two-thirds of the eye is covered, so it doesn't tend to dry out quite as much. But again, that variety, having those breaks, and 20 minutes, that 20-minute rule is just quite a broad one. If kids are reading a chapter book, I'll often say, well, you know, at the end of every other page, just, you know, take a look, blink a few times, look outside and see what's down the road, and then come back and carry on. Because if you're a good reader and you love a book, it's hard to know how long you're in it. You do take a break. So
tell me a little bit more about blinking, and what are the advantages of blinking?
You want to keep the moisture layer on the front of your eye even and consistent. If you don't blink very often and you haven't got a good layer of moisture, that layer of moisture breaks up and gets holes through it, so it doesn't keep the front of the eye moist. Yeah. Your tear film probably makes up about a third of the quality of your vision. So if you haven't got a great tear film and you're getting patches and distortion through that layer, it's kind of like having a bad window or put in, you know, it's kind of distorted and it's not as sharp and bright as it could be. So yeah, you definitely get a better quality of vision and you feel more comfortable. You don't get the same sort of stingy, dry, kind of tired feeling eyes that you do when you keep that moisture layer really replenished. I guess it's like if you have cracked lips, it's just a little bit more sensitive. It's not quite as comfortable. And if you can keep it moist and protected on the surface, then yeah, you're going to feel better both visually and comfort-wise.
So if people are listening to this and they're wondering some more about looking after their children's eyes, what resources and where could people go to find out what to do?
Most optometrists will have optometrists that deal with children. So if you are making an appointment to see an optometrist, then checking that you've got someone who is comfortable with children is definitely something that you want to follow up on, because yeah, just like, I guess if you take your kid to the doctor, you want someone who's kind of comfortable with children. There's a lot more information on the internet now, particularly with the myopia control. And myopia profile is the optometrist one, and the name of the child, the family one just gone out of my head, where they've got a whole lot of links for families with myopia and what options and the statistics behind things, so that when families are presented with that. And otherwise, yeah, it's just all those games and things, that anything where you are looking, searching, moving, playing those kind of games with your kids is really important.
We'll put that link up in the podcast so that you don't have to recall it right now.
Thank you. It just got out of my head. Like I said, I usually go to the myopia profile is the one for the professionals. And they've got a really good one for families, which is at a level that everybody can understand.
Makes more sense. Okay, well, thank you very much. Is there something else that you'd like to share with us about eye care?
No, just don't underestimate the importance of it. There's, you know, I've had families that have had children really struggling at school, and they haven't thought about getting eye tests done. And I guess the same way as, you know, getting the ears tested and things, if there's issues there for concentration, like it might be that they can see, you know, if I point out a sign, they can see it. If there's any issues at school or anything where they aren't at the level that they would expect, it's always a good place just to get, just to start and see what's around and if there's any issues there. But otherwise, yeah, can't overemphasize enough just playing all those games with your kids. It's like fun. You get quality time together and you're actually helping them with their visual development in the meantime, which is definitely a win-win situation. And then, yeah, like our parents said, go outside, get outside.
Fantastic. So that's really nice. And we've got some weekends coming up, so hopefully we'll be able to have more time to do that.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for spending this time with me today, Kieran. And we will keep talking and sharing information.
Okay. Thank you for having me.